This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Bill DeBuys. He is a writer and conservationist. He's written many award-winning books on the Southwest and the natural world. His 1985 book, Enchantment and Exploitation, The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range, has been reissued in a revised and expanded 30th anniversary edition by the University of New Mexico Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be back.
Great to have you back. I love this book. It is so wide-ranging. It's hard to imagine that you wrote it as a young man because it's so full of wisdom and insight and stories and just great writing. And I was sort of imagining you as a person who was, well, you were young, you were maybe no longer a brand new newcomer on this land, but you were also not born here. And maybe you were walking the mountain ranges here in northern New Mexico. Maybe you were driving around. You found a crashed plane with four frozen bodies in it. And I kind of have this feeling of you trying to imagine the many meanings of this land and what its history was and what stories were buried in it. Well, you tell us, what was the impetus? What was the seed for this book?
Well, I think I understand the seed for it better in retrospect than I did at the time. Looking back now, I can see this book as just an effort to answer one of the most fundamental questions we can ask, which is, where am I? I was East Coast born, bred, and educated, came out to New Mexico for my first job after college, and found myself in this very, very different place, living in the northern villages. And over time, I just determined, well, I wanted to be a writer. What are you going to write about, Bill? So, well, I think I could write maybe something about those mountains. And so I began just trying to write about the mountains. And this book is what eventually resulted after a long and complicated process with a lot of setbacks, reversals, rewritings, and then pushing forward again.
This book is so wide-ranging. It tells stories, it tells natural history, it tells social history and economics, and there's so much in it, and it's kind of like a genre that, I mean, what do you call it, and how did people respond to it?
Well, these days it would be called a work of environmental history, or bioregional history, in that it sweeps up and discusses changes in the land, social history, political history, cultural history, the whole deal, but really that tight interactive relationship between society and the natural environment. When I wrote the book, mostly in the late 70s and early 80s, and it finally, after sort of a battle, came out in 1985, well, in those years, the American Society for Environmental History had formed, but not very many people knew about it. I certainly didn't know about it until after I had taken this book as a manuscript to graduate school, and then finally I heard about these things that were in the wind, and this book was kind of a naive contribution to this new forming stream of historical discourse that brought the land, that brought nature into the flow of history.
So you were really part of inventing new ways of seeing and writing and bringing people into that narrative about land and people and their interaction.
Yeah, quite unintentionally. I mean, I wanted to write about those interactions, but I didn't realize that my little efforts were going to flow into a larger river that today is a very established subdiscipline in history. I mean, there are environmental historians in the departments of university after university today.
One of the things that I got from the book is that you can't really see the mountains and their plants and animals and rocks and geology and so on directly. You see them through various perspectives, and each successive wave of people over centuries, over millennia, have different perspectives on this place. Let's go back, because that's where you start too. I mean, you write about the Pueblo Indians. What do we know about their lives before the Spanish got here, about their worldview, about their relationship to the land? And I ask this because I think one of the themes of the book is that people's relationship to their land says so much about their values, about who they are, and about what they do all day.
Yes. And the Pueblo worldview is really a beautiful and symmetric and complete worldview. And as our dear departed friend Rena Swensel would have said, it's a worldview that's not just full of people. It's a worldview that includes the creatures of the land and the wind and the soil and the trees and so forth. She speaks so eloquently of the water wind breath that flows through everything. People, soil, rocks, plants, animals, everything. And so in a way, the Pueblo worldview, I think, is a much more complete and unified worldview than that which Anglo culture has brought to the region.
My sense is that that is codified in what we in English might call spiritual practice, but I always wonder, I mean, for example, for Catholics, spiritual practice might be limited to Sundays.
Yeah.
To Mass, yeah. Right? And so, to what extent did that worldview permeate the actions and way of living of Puebloan people?
This was a worldview that suffused every aspect of life. It wasn't something practiced on feast days or Sundays. It ran through quotidian existence. It was there all the time. And there's a great beauty in that. To think, for instance, that, you know, you have the bowl that nourishes you, and that the kiva is a bowl of somewhat larger size, and the pueblo itself is a bowl of yet larger size, and then the pueblo is contained within the bowl of the Rio Grande Valley. And so there are these successive bowls. Everything is a bowl, and the bowl is female, and the sky is a basket, and it's male that fits upon the top of the bowl, the way the roof of the kiva fits on the top of the kiva. It's a woven kind of basket. So there's just this beautiful poetry and symmetry running through the structure of that worldview.
One of the things that's so striking about that is the basket on top of the bowl is a metaphor of a sphere.
Yes.
And we also have our metaphor of the sphere, but we're kind of like on top of a little convex part of it. We're not contained by it.
Mm-hmm. So we're inside this Puebloan sphere.
Yeah.
But not just with our other humans for company. We have all the rest of creation for company.
And there's a kind of respect in that that I think 20th and 21st century people like to romanticize, which is the respect for all life and respect for the deer that you kill and all of that. And embedded in that romanticism is this idea that nature was not exploited, but it was well understood and well used by Native people, by Puebloan people. Is that true, do you think?
Well, there's a real danger in romanticizing any period of human activity to say that people lived in perfect balance. Well, there's never been a human community that lived in perfect balance with its environment, I really don't believe. But there have been better and worse balances. And I think a lot of the balance in the deep past of this region was pretty doggone good. You know, imperfect, pueblos had to relocate from time to time because of resource exhaustion, because of disease, because of this or that. So it wasn't absolutely perfect. The equilibrium was always a dynamic equilibrium, and once in a while it had to be reset. And there was certainly a lot of warfare within that world, a lot of violence. Nevertheless, there's a lot to admire in it, a lot that should make us in our contemporary world feel fairly humble when we regard it.
We're talking to Bill DeBuise about his book Enchantment and Exploitation. So when the Spanish came, there was a lot of bloody conflict, but you write about something else as well, which is a kind of mutual influences between the native and Spanish cultures. What did that look like?
Well, there's a big difference between the 17th century Spanish occupation of New Mexico and the 18th century occupation, because of the Pueblo Revolt. And after the Pueblo Revolt, the Spanish realized that they had to ally themselves to some degree with the Pueblos, that the Pueblos could not simply be their slaves, could not simply be people they would exploit. The two cultures had common enemies in Apaches periodically, in Comanches most of the time, Navajos some of the time. And so they had to join together. They had common interests, and they learned from each other. The Pueblos, of course, utilized lots of Spanish technology, Spanish animals, and the Spaniards, for their part, began to live more and more like as the Pueblos did. They had to eke out at sort of the peasant level of their society. They had to eke out very simple lives of sustenance. And that's what they did in village after village after village, raising crops, herding animals, more or less the way the Pueblos did.
And the Spanish came, by and large, without women, so they were mixing families from the get-go.
Well, there was always a lot of that. They did come with women. Some of those women were Tlaxcalan Indians from Mexico. I mean, there was just the grand mezcla of ethnicities going on all the time. It was a very poor family indeed that could not afford an Indian slave or servant, probably maybe a captured Navajo, Kiowa, other Plains Indian, etc. So there was a constant flow of people of different backgrounds, different genomes flowing through the society.
Well, that's something else I wanted to ask you about, which was the relationship between this region here in northern New Mexico and Spain and Mexico, and then later independent Mexico. What was that communication and cross-pollination like? I mean, to some extent, we were pretty remote.
Yeah, and I think what happened over especially the 18th century and into the early part of the 19th century is that New Mexico, as an isolated appendage of the culture that was evolving down in old Mexico, there was a transformation here. People became new Mexicans. It was the development of a rooted, area-specific culture of far northern Mexico that took place here.
And the language kind of changed and evolved to be a different language from the Spanish in Spain.
Yeah, it was far from the currents of educated Spanish or Mexican society. And so turns of phrase, archaisms, tended to hang in the language used here in northern New Mexico, so that, let's say, an inspector for the church coming north in 1776, Fray Atanasio Dominguez, would remark in his journal that the people here speak a kind of peculiar Spanish that sounds very antiquated and it would hardly be understood in Mexico City. Things like that.
Yeah. Now, I've read this book, and full disclosure, I'm not good with war and violence. And so when we got to those chapters, I had to kind of skim a little bit over because we have a horribly bloody history here in many ways. But just for the sake of talking a little more about New Mexico history, who fought whom over what and when?
Well, there were so many different fights. I mean, the Pueblo Revolt, the great wars against the Comanches in the 18th century, and various rebellions. At one time, the governor of New Mexico, Albino Perez, was decapitated and his head used for a football. A few years after that came the American invasion in 1846 and the Taos Revolt in 1847, and we had some activity of the Civil War in the 1860s, and then continuous conflict with surrounding Indian tribes, really, really intense from the 1860s on through into the 1880s. So there's been plenty of violence in this part of the world.
There have also been so many ways in which ecosystems in what is now New Mexico have been ravaged. I mean, the trapping of beavers, the hunting of elk, both to virtual extinction, mining, overgrazing. When did these things happen? Who was behind them? And above all, what was the mindset driving them? I mean, we're so far now from a kind of Puebloan mindset of the breath of the land and respect for life and all of that.
Well, there was a lot of push for economic gain that came with mining, with grazing, with timber exploitation at various times. I mean, so many of the railroad ties to double track the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad across the Southwest. So many of those ties were cut in the mountains up where I live now, around Peñasco, and the old Santa Barbara land grant was a major source for those timbers. So there were waves of different, almost the way there are economic waves that we surf today. I mean, the whole internet economy that we're seeing, you know, rise and fall and rise again around us today, that's like the open range cattle industry of the 1870s and 80s, or the timber rushes of the 90s and aughts. Very similar kinds of economic waves. Here's a new technology. Here's a new opportunity. Here's a new need. Let's go fill it as fast as we can. And that's what people did.
To the incredible detriment of the land, to the point where overgrazed land becomes unusable and barren and leads to, I mean, in all of these things, whether it be the dot-com or whether it be cattle grazing in the late 19th century, a huge boom-bust kind of cycle.
Yeah, I mean, New Mexico in the 1870s and 80s and on for several decades, it's hard today to imagine how hammered it was. It was really in bad shape, and the landscape was fundamentally transformed. Today, looking at the land in many places, it's impossible to reconstruct how it was before that period of super heavy use. I mean, one of the most characteristic landforms we have around us here is the arroyo. Well, most arroyos in northern New Mexico actually formed in the 1870s and right after that. Now, other arroyos had probably formed in other geologic cycles, but as one geologist put it, in those years, we compressed the geologic activity of several centuries into several decades.
So how did that lead to the formation of essentially dry rivers? Well, wet rivers that became dry rivers.
Well, we had, you know, with kind of systematic overgrazing that happened at that time, the land cover was stripped. There seems also to have been a higher than usual frequency of really energetically intense thunderstorms in that period, which produced a lot of erosive energy from the rain. So a lot of soil, a lot of gravel and sand was washed off the land and down into the major rivers. And the rivers were, of course, aggrading with all this detritus in them, and so there were more floods. The river channels weren't big enough to carry away all that material. It was a really interesting dynamic of landscape change. In fact, if you like to observe landscape change, that would have been a great time to be alive. But right now, today, is probably a greater time, because with climate change, we're seeing a number of these processes kick back into high gear, and we're watching our landscape change at a terrific rate. I mean, just if we could look out the window here right now at the east face of the Hemis Mountains, we would see that in the last couple of decades, basically the forests of the east face of the Hemis have been burned off. That's a big change. They're not going to come back exactly the way they were from this, because they're coming back now into a warmer environment with new conditions, and what we will see will probably be something that we've never quite seen before.
And fire is such a tricky thing to talk about, because there's natural fire, and there's human-caused fire, and there's fire that becomes crazy because of fire suppression, and all of those things are dynamics happening in the forests of northern New Mexico.
That's exactly right. And to be honest, in the first edition of Enchantment and Exploitation, almost as soon as the book came out back in 1985, I began reading research about forest health in northern New Mexico and in the Southwest generally, and I began to regret that I hadn't written more about forests in that original edition of the book. And doing this revised edition has given me the opportunity to now include material on forests and on fire ecology that I felt the earlier book was missing. And that's really what the new final chapter of Enchantment and Exploitation in this revised edition is about. So it's not often that one gets to go back and correct errors of 30 years ago, but doing this new edition has allowed me to repair a couple of them.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting when you talk about forests is the concept of wilderness, which I think many conservation-minded people think of as a good thing. Wilderness is not as much an ecological as a social concept. What
exactly
do you mean by that?
Well, we invent this concept of wilderness as though it's a pristine place, that it's just as nature intended it. Well, that's not quite on the mark. Almost every landscape has been changed by humans over the years, and every landscape has been evolving. The concept of wilderness in American discourse didn't come up until the people who lived in those places, the Native Americans, had been removed from them. So if we really want to talk about pristine nature, we have to include early people. But those early people were early and virtually contemporary people. Those people were changing the landscape as they occupied it. So the Aldo Leopold definition of wilderness as a place that could absorb a two-week pack trip, that works. That's kind of pragmatic, just absorb a two-week pack trip. But the idea of wilderness as being somehow a pristine slice of the original creation, that's pretty nutty, because we've subtracted from that creation the people who dwelled in it for such a long time. I think if we were going to devise a definition for wilderness today and to build a wilderness preservation system from scratch today, we might come round to the idea that, okay, what wilderness really is an area where we as a society celebrate a virtue that we don't usually have very much of, and that's restraint. Just,
yeah.
Wilderness is a place where we leave it alone as much as we can.
You write very eloquently about wilderness as a place for moral education.
Yeah, it is. Where we can go and test ourselves, where we can go and explore silence, explore conditions and activities that are very different from what we experience in our day-to-day lives. I myself feel as though the Pecos wilderness was one of the great teachers in my life. As a young man, I would go up there for long periods of time. One time, for instance, a two-week solo backpack. I basically saw no one for 2 weeks and carried all my gear for that time at one fell swoop. And I came away from that experience fundamentally changed, I think. It was a significant rite of passage in my life. I didn't understand that at the time, but again, retrospectively, you can get a sharper view.
How do you think you changed?
For one thing, because of that experience, I fell in love with Earth, with the land, with this place in a deeper way than I had ever done before. I also learned, and this may sound trivial, but in the course of that trip, I learned that moods were like letters. There's no point in indulging in a mood unless you can communicate it to someone. And I found that when I was alone by myself for 2 weeks at a time, I stopped having moods. I stopped having periods of elation or periods of depression or sulkiness or petulance or any of those things. And I just hit this smooth, even keel and could be in touch with an inner self that was farther from my reach when I was mixed in with family and friends and all the emotional interactions of day-to-day life. So that was a profound experience for me.
That's fascinating. The idea that a mood is a fundamentally people-relational phenomenon.
Yeah, it's like a letter, and if you can't mail it, you don't write it. That's the metaphor that I came away with.
Interesting. We're talking to Bill DeBuys about his book, Enchantment and Exploitation, The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range. It's interesting, when we were talking earlier about hiking and backpacking and your experience, there's a dynamic that you describe, which I think is very true and very interesting, between, on the one hand, hikers who like to go out and hike into the mountains and challenge themselves and so on, and then people who live in villages who don't go out and do that kind of thing and kind of look down on the hikers, and the hikers look down on them. Describe that dynamic.
Well, it's just a lack of cross-cultural communication in a way. The hikers might get offended when they see a cow in a meadow, and that cow's there because somebody from one of the villages is still ranching and still running cattle in the high country in the summer. Well, why does that person run cattle up there? Is it to make the last dollar he can? Probably not. That person is probably running cattle up there in spite, not because of, the economics of the ranching. And that person is running those cows up there not because he doesn't like or has no feeling for the mountains. It's because he really loves them. And the process of bringing his cattle up and tending them and then taking them down gives him the framework to be in that extraordinary environment in a way that makes sense to him, not as a recreational tourist. That wouldn't make sense. It's just the same way that for the recreational tourist, the rancher's activity up there doesn't sometimes make sense. So if the two sides could see each other's motives as being really quite similar, motivated by a real love and attraction for the land, then maybe we'd get somewhere.
Well, there's also a deep history of what that land was before and who owned it. I mean, we have these land grants that were broken up in highly nefarious ways over the course of New Mexico history that were real coherent collective communities.
Yeah, yeah. And so in various ways, people strive to find reconnections to those ancestral links to the land.
I mean, some of that land is now owned by the Forest Service, for example.
Yeah. A lot of the land grants were broken up, that were sold wholesale to private speculators, and then those speculators in some instances would flip them to the Forest Service, or they would go bankrupt and the Forest Service would pick it up for a song, things like that over many years. In lots of instances, the Forest Service is blamed for being the perpetrator of the land grant shenanigans, and that's really usually not accurate. Rather, the Forest Service inherited the blame when it acquired the land from the real perpetrators.
And you go into this in some real detail in the book, including acts of resistance along the way, and it's more than we can go into now, but it does illustrate some really big questions about changes in paradigm about land. I mean, you have first Native American people about whom we don't know all that much, but who were living here. You have Puebloan people who've been here for a very long time and are still here, whose sense of ownership does not include, or did not include, things like title deeds and demarcated boundaries on maps. Then you have land grants that does have demarcated boundaries on maps, but it's still a sense of collective ownership.
Yes.
And then you have that giving way to individual ownership.
Right, and to the privatization of all resource. And then you have another revolution, which was a reassertion of communal ownership, even in Anglo society. And that's what national forests and national parks and BLM lands are really all about. We had a terrific wave of privatization in the 19th century, but then we had a corrective movement, which was the conservation movement, establishing these latter-day kinds of communal ownership. And actually, in the recent occupation at Malheur National Wildlife Refuge that was in the news, that's a counter-revolution against this assertion of national collective interest in our public land. And it's such a peculiar, such a narrow telling of the story that the folks at Malheur were doing. It's really shameful that the media didn't call them to account for that, because we have a very deep tradition of public lands in the United States. And I think we in northern New Mexico are blessed to have terrific public land opportunities all around us.
Another thing that your book does so beautifully is it tells stories of characters who lived on this land over time. And I don't know, maybe you could tell us a little how you collected these various stories. One of them that really struck me was this guy, this Italian guy named Giovanni Maria Agostini. Who was he?
The Hermit of Hermit's Peak. And as I was working on the book, I was interested in the folklore, you know, the kind of story that seemed to grow right out of the land, or the kind of story that people coming here would paint onto the land. Giovanni Agostini was a perfect example of that, this Italian wanderer who walked all the way down the Santa Fe Trail, had by then already wandered over much of South America into the shadow of Chimborazo in Ecuador, and here and there, I mean, the place names on his passport papers were exotic and strange, and he had the aura of a holy man, of a saint, and also of a healer. And he came and lived first in a cave in a canyon near Romeroville, over by Las Vegas. And then he moved up to the cave near the top of Hermit's Peak, which at that time was known as the Cerro del Tecolote, Owl Mountain. But it became known as Hermit's Peak because of him. He was revered by local people and was credited with some significant acts of healing. Eventually he left and continued on down the old Camino Real and wound up near Las Cruces and took up residence in a cave just to the east of Las Cruces, a place called, of all things, La Cueva.
La Cueva, meaning the cave.
Yeah. And he was found murdered there. And the murder was never solved.
He was found, his skeleton was found, or his body was found years later with a dagger in his back.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It may not have been all that much later after he died.
I mean,
once again, he had become known to local people, and they came to him from time to time with gifts of food and sometimes with a request for a healing act. And somebody went up there to call on him and found him dead, stabbed.
And we will never know who did that or why. But one of the things that's so interesting is that stories of people like him still really do resonate today. I mean, he was credited with poking the ground and a spring bubbled forth.
A spring.
And you met people.
Flowed forth, yeah.
Yeah, and you met people who were going up to Hermit's Peak in a very devotional way, or to Hermit's Spring, to gather water.
A man climbing the mountain barefoot when there was still snow on the ground. He was fulfilling a promesa, a vow, a promise that he had made. I don't know what kind of thing he was asking the supernatural for, but something significant. And he was making the trip, and he was going to collect some water from the hermit's spring up on top of the mountain. So the hermit, for all I know, still inspires these devotional acts. And for all I know, people still occasionally wander around the high country looking for the hermit's gold, even as the presence of the hermit caused stories of religious significance to spread. They also cause stories to spread that he actually had a hoard of riches and he hid them in the mountains, and on from there. And there's quite a lot of lore along those lines that's also sort of centered on the high mountains, the mine of the lost padres and the hermit's gold and all these other crazy stories.
One of the things that makes New Mexico the place it is, as we see in your book, is that a lot of American society, quote-unquote Anglo society, really looked down on New Mexico, didn't necessarily want to come here. Maybe it wasn't exploited quite as much as places like California and Texas, or invaded as much. And that kind of racism and superiority ran along the lines of white is better than brown, Protestant is better than Catholic, civilized versus primitive, rich versus poor. That's all a big part of our history.
Yeah, it is a big part of our history. One of the reasons it took so long for New Mexico territory to become a state was that the rest of the United States didn't feel too friendly about a place where the primary language was Spanish and not English, where the primary religion was Catholicism and not Protestantism, and where most of the people were of different ethnicities. They were Hispano or they were Indian, and Indian includes so many different ethnicities. So that was, in a sense, a burden for New Mexico, but it was also, in another sense, a blessing, because it kept New Mexico different. It kept New Mexico smaller in population, less stressed. New Mexico didn't grow fast like Arizona, and I think those of us who live here are very glad that it didn't.
There's a passage that you have in your book that I wanted to read aloud, which I found really interesting. You wrote, "In great cities like New York and San Francisco, one can find as much or more cultural diversity. And here or there, on certain Indian reservations or in Appalachia or southern Louisiana, one finds historical continuities as long or longer. But northern New Mexico has few, if any, rivals in the degree to which it so richly combines both diversity and continuity." And I think that this book, which contains so many kinds of history, natural history and cultural history, kind of illustrates that unique mix that we are.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also you could say that northern New Mexico combines natural diversity with human diversity and cultural diversity to a degree perhaps found nowhere else in the United States, and certainly found in few places in a degree that would rival what we have here. That, to me, is one of the greatest sources of wealth in this region, and something, I think, of which all northern New Mexicans can be justifiably proud.
One of the buzzwords that one hears now when talking about how are we going to survive the various ecological disasters that we human beings have created for ourselves and everybody else is resilience. What does resilience mean to you? What do you think resilience means here in northern New Mexico?
Well, once upon a time, I was down at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, and Bill McKibben, the great writer and organizer of 350.org, one of the great activists on climate change, Bill gave a talk, and after the talk, I was standing near him, and a lady came up and asked a follow-up question. She said, okay, climate change is coming. What do we do to prepare? And he looked at her and he said, the best thing to do is to live in a strong community. And she asked the obvious follow-up question, how do we find a strong community? And he said, you don't. You build it. And so how do we build strong communities? How do we build resilient communities? Well, I think a big factor is to have agreement on fundamental values about how we live and how we treat each other. And another fundamental aspect is to have a sense of a strong equality of the worth of all the members of the community being the same. Maybe some are richer than others, maybe some are more educated than others, maybe some have this or some have that, but a sense that everybody is worth the same, everyone has the same standing. To me, those things are the essence of a strong community and the essence of a resilient community. If you have that, then you can deal with the sort of policy issues and the resource issues and the sharing issues and so forth. But unless you have those things, that sense of individual equality and that sense of shared value system, then it's really hard to discuss the other things.
When I read how people talked about one another not that long ago, a century ago, less than a century ago, in New Mexico, how white people talked about Indians, how public officials talked about what should be done with land and why, and the value of the people or non-value of the people living there. I mean, we're not living in paradise right now, but we sure have come a long way. Because even to the extent that we have not lived up to our moral values of equality, they're there every day in, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement and everything else.
It's an unfinished project, and we're still working on it. We'll always still be working on it. But that vision expressed way back in the Declaration of Independence is something that we should be trying in the United States to live up to, and trying a little harder, making a little more progress every year.
When we think about the fact, I mean, what you're talking about is how you build resilient communities is by living by the words of Thomas Jefferson. All men, let's cross out men and put people, are created equal, and so on. Does that...
Which Jefferson had a very hard time living by. Let's be honest, you know.
Right. But I mean, does that resonate with people whose roots are not in that America?
Yes, I think so, because what Jefferson was expressing was a set of Enlightenment values, and one of those values was tolerance and a sense of equality among all individuals. And so those two things are essential for any kind of multi-ethnic, multicultural society. They make room for everyone. If you don't have those things, you don't have the room to include everyone.
The book is called Enchantment and Exploitation: The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range. We didn't even name the mountain range.
Well, the mountain range is basically the Sangre de Cristo.
Right.
Yeah. But the subject matter of the book ranges outward far and wide, with no particular plan or discipline The book just ranges around to include the stories that I felt I needed to have in there, the stories that I really wanted to tell.
But it does, and this is why, I mean, I think anybody who lives or is making their home in northern New Mexico really would be well advised to read this book, because it does give a sense of place and it does give a sense of history. And one of the things that it gave me was a sense that this time I'm living in will also change, and the next generation and the one after that and a century from now, 2 centuries from now, these hills and mountains that I love and that you love and that we all look at with awe, you know, when the sun sets and they turn that kind of green crimson in the late afternoon, they will be there. And people's relationship to them will be something that maybe we can't even imagine yet.
That's right. I mean, the mountains themselves will be there. The look of the mountains may be very different. We are probably going into an era powered by climate change in which the vegetation of the landscapes around us, including the high mountains, will change quite a lot. So what we see up on the mountains today may not be what's there in 20, 30, 40 years. Could be very different.
And yet, one of the things that is encouraging is that the elk are back. The beavers are back. There's some river otters now that were gone. The sense of importance in doing ecological restoration, whether that's being done by conservation groups or government entities or farmers and ranchers themselves, is there in a way that it wasn't even 50 years ago.
Yeah, we have a richer forest world today than we did 120 or 30 years ago. Far richer. And that's been, to my way of thinking, a true cultural positive for us.
It's almost time to go, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the process of revising this book, about coming back to it 30 years later and creating this new 30th anniversary edition.
Well, it was a real pleasure to go back into what I had written as a young man. I'm 30-some years older now, and it was an interesting adventure to try to encounter that younger version of myself who was there behind the words that I was revising this time around. And then I added an entirely new chapter and a half to the book. It's like having a chance to go back and take something that you really cherish and make it better and make it more contemporary, anew. So it was a real privilege to be able to do this, and I'm so glad the book has come out.
As we talked about before, this book was really on the forefront of a new genre of history. How was it received when it came out and in the years since then?
Well, at first it wasn't received at all because, as you know, the procedure for a university press is to take a manuscript and send it out to senior scholars and ask them to come and, is this thing worth publishing or not? And the first people who reviewed my manuscript basically said, no, it's not. Because why is this guy talking so much about the land and the water? We don't know, you know, this history is only history if you do it the way we've been doing
right.
It, basically. So this book would not have been published except for the wonderful commitment to it of an editor at the University of New Mexico Press by the name of Beth Haddis, who is still today a dear, dear friend, who fought for the book and who, as a very savvy editor, just kept sending it out for review until she finally got the answer she wanted. She wouldn't take no for an answer. She just kept sending it out because she said basically to herself and to her colleagues, I enjoyed reading this book. I think other people will enjoy reading it too. And therefore, we should publish it and people will buy it and they'll like it. And because of Beth's persistence, the book finally came out in 1985, and it certainly never hit the New York Times bestseller list, but it sold something north of 20,000 copies over the years, and that's not too bad. And it's been continuously in print. It went through, I think, 10 printings in the original version, and now it's out in a new and revised and expanded edition. And it's respected, actually, by other practitioners in the field. It's been assigned in a lot of college courses and a lot of graduate school courses. It's found a readership in the field, but also with the general public.
And I think that's the thing that's important to me. Well, of course, it's important in universities because when people are young, a book like this will form their way, help to form their ways of seeing. But also for the rest of us, and I was thinking about this as I was reading, it's like the experiences that you had that led to the writing of this book were so deep that no matter how hard you try, you can't fully give us those experiences. But you can stimulate us to have our own in a way,
yeah.
To spend more time, to go out on the land, to reflect on what you've said, to have our own reflections.
Yeah, and because I enter the narrative, not a lot, but at various times as a character, I tell a personal story, I think it makes the book more immediate to people. It's not something that's written in third person at arm's length. Once in a while, this kind of bumbling gringo stumbles into the story and has a personal epiphany that is worth sharing with the reader.
Bill DeBuys, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.